This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Follow the money is the classic line, right? But the question now is, where did it go? Libya, after Gaddafi on the broadcast today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Thursday, today the 20th of October. Good to have you with us. The official announcement of Libyan liberation, now that Muammar Gaddafi is dead, will come Saturday, the National Transitional Council said today. And then surely not long after that, the question of what comes next. Because at some point, talk is going to turn to rebuilding and how to pay for it. One way to do that might be to sell off some of the investments that Gaddafi made with his country's oil revenue. We're talking tens of billions of dollars here, spread across much of Africa. Marketplace's Scott Tong is just back from a reporting trip to East Africa, Nairobi, Kenya to be precise, where he kept bumping into those Libyan investments.
As soon as I land in Kenya...
Hey, how you doing?
Hey, Jumbo. My name is Peter. Welcome to Kenya.
My cabbie Peter notes my hotel, the Lyco Grand Regency. The Libyans own it, he says, and now it's run down.
It was one of the best hotels in those days.
Not anymore?
Not anymore.
At first blush, it impresses. It has a glass elevator, or as they say in Kenya, lift.
You can see futuristic view. You can see everything. You can see the bar. You can see the balconies from the rooms. What else do you expect?
Across Africa, Libya has made investments like this. Analyst Peter Pham at the Atlantic Council estimates $15 billion worth the last decade.
You have investments in everything from the pipeline between Eldoret, Kenya, and Kampala, Uganda, to telecommunications, to luxury resorts in Rwanda, Ghana, agriculture in Liberia, Mali.
Pham says Gaddafi invested in different phases. First, revolutions in the 60s and 70s, then Middle Eastern terrorists. And since the 1980s, he invested across Africa, in part to win friends.
Most African countries have stood by Gaddafi, or at least not embrace the rebel cause. So the investments worked not only economically, but politically.
So not all investments were made for pure business reasons.
Oh, you're a taxi driver at the airport.
Which may explain why the bar at the Regency Hotel is empty. Cabbie Peter notes the carpets are worn, the brass rails are scuffed.
I don't think these seats have never been changed for all those years.
It shows it's aged.
The Libyans bought this hotel in 2008. But even before that, the place was fishy, says Nairobi economic analyst Robert Shaw.
That it was a product of a very infamous age here called the Goldenberg. There was a series of scams.
Illegally subsidized profits paid for the Regency to be built, he says. At some point, it went bankrupt, and the Libyans scooped it up for cheap. Rumor has it under an exclusive contract to Gaddafi's government.
Gaddafi and his era, he did have quite a large following because he had a lot of money to throw at things and at people, and he was famous for that.
Peter, the cabbie, takes me to another Libya monument in Nairobi, one of the many Libya oil gas stations. This is amazing. There's almost an entire strip mall attached, So as you buy gas,
you can pick up a pizza for the kids. You can have a chicken leg. There is a drugstore. There are so many things you can do at the same time. You can have a beer.
And then get back behind the wheel. For Libya, this is a performing asset. But Gaddafi's now gone. So what now? Analyst Peter Pham expects a Libya asset sell-off, a global estate sale, if you will.
The new government of Libya is going to need significant amounts of cash, not only to rebuild from the civil war to overthrow the Gaddafi regime, but to make up for literally four decades in which Gaddafi's adventures abroad have come at the cost of neglect at home.
It's too soon to know what may be sold off and to whom, but the smart money here assumes China. Whoever buys, perhaps the next owner, will spruce up the Lyco Regency Hotel. In Nairobi, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, a world away from Libya and the news of the day, traders worked hard to get themselves back to even. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Ever since the Libyan revolution started, people have been looking for Colonel Gaddafi's money and how to get it all back to Libya and to the Libyan people. Mark Vlasic teaches law at Georgetown University. He used to be the head of operations at the Stolen Asset Recovery Initiative at the World Bank. Mark, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you.
The simple question is probably the best one here. Is the fact that Muammar Gaddafi is now dead going to make it tougher to track down his assets?
I think likely it will be a bit easier because people who are trying to protect his assets because of personal relationships with him perhaps will not feel that personal connection now that he's no longer with us.
The assets that are still inside the country, is it cash and jewels and bearer bonds and all that easily liquid stuff?
I would imagine it's anything and everything. Yeah, he's been in power for, what, 42 years now? He's been placed under sanctions before. He knows quite well how to hide and stash his money. So my guess is he's probably become pretty good at this. It's incredibly complex work, and it takes a incredible amount of time to actually try to uncover what he's hidden.
Is everything necessarily ill-gotten gains?
It depends how you want to look at it. For the money has been frozen and it is in part of the Libyan investment fund is money that obviously should be returned to Libya. The question is, of the money that Gaddafi was able to siphon off for himself, that money is clearly ill-gotten gains. And my guess is he has used parts of the government as an extension of his own piggy bank, if you look at other past dictators and that they've done that. So I think it's quite possibly he's done the same. And so I think that the people working on this case we'll be spending a lot of time trying to figure out what is the illicit origin of the funds that are located around the world.
Yeah. Well, speaking of around the world, what are the odds that in the next number of months or years or however long this takes, we're going to find Swiss bank accounts and things in New York City and London?
Well, I think a lot of the money has actually been frozen already, particularly the money that was located in the United States and Switzerland. In fact, the Swiss, to their credit, were the first country to freeze his assets. And I think in terms of looking forward, it's important to recognize that it's not just the Libyans working on this by themselves. There's international organizations that have been set up. You know, Bob Zelik, the president of the World Bank, to his credit, set up the Stolen Asset Recovery Initiative to really help countries track and recover stolen assets from past dictators. So now countries that have signed on to this are in a greater obligation to assist the Libyans with this operation.
Is there a common thread that runs through dictators and their loot, for want of a better term? I'm thinking, you know, Saddam Hussein and Hosni Mubarak and now Gaddafi. I mean, is there a similarity?
Yeah, I was lucky enough to work as one of the prosecution attorneys on the Slobodan Milosevic case, and have since been involved in the Saddam case and a few other matters. And what I've noticed from my experience is the same people who are willing to slaughter thousands or millions of people are the same people who are willing to steal millions or billions of dollars. And I think for far too long, the international community has really been focused only on the war crimes aspect, which of course is incredibly, incredibly important, but oftentimes forgot about the corruption side of things. In the past, when terrible dictators who had died or fled and lived in exile, nobody talked about the money that was stolen from those countries. Now, one of the first things that happens is people are talking about, what about the money? How do we get the money back? And how do we use that money that's been stolen from the people in those countries to return to that country to help those countries in their own personal development?
Mark Vlasic, thanks a lot.
Thanks for your time.
Given the state of the American housing market, sellers are offering all kinds of incentives to buyers. Granite countertops, a finished basement, and now a visa to live here. There's a bill being introduced in the Senate that would give residence visas to foreigners who buy homes in the U.S. So how much might that actually do to shore up the American housing market? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer takes a look.
Here's how it would work. Foreigners plunk down at least $500,000 on a house in the U.S. and get a visa. The visa wouldn't allow them to work here. They'd have to have a work permit for that. But they could live here as long as they own the house. Ruth Sells thinks this is a great idea. She's a realtor in the Phoenix area.
It would just put you back out there on the streets every day trying to find these people homes.
Sells says she already has a fair number of Canadian clients. According to Zillow.com, foreigners spent more than $80 billion on U.S. homes for the year ending in March, a 24% increase from the year before. Stan Humphries is Zillow's chief economist. He says trading visas for verandas makes sense in this housing market.
There is no silver bullet out there, and really the path forward is going to be a lot of really small steps like this that we're going to take.
Not everybody's convinced. Anthony Sanders teaches real estate finance at George Mason University. He says it's clear that foreigners are already flocking to the U.S. to buy homes, so they don't need incentives. Plus, he worries that if we get too much foreign investment...
Oops, then we start getting bubbles. This smacks me as having a very large probability of unintended consequences hitting.
Zillow economist Humphries says you get around that by making the visa program temporary, so it's over before prices can spike. There is still time to tinker with the visa legislation. It hasn't hit the floor of either House of Congress yet. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
The discount flyer Southwest Airlines released quarterly profits today. Fares were up and planes were full, but still the company was hit with its first quarterly loss in 2 years. And that's where the irony comes in, because Southwest lost money on its fuel hedges, future purchases of gas for its jets. Hedges have made money for Southwest in the past, but Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports that their luck changed when oil prices fell this past summer.
Airlines buy fuel hedges to protect against volatility in the oil market. When airlines like Southwest lock in high prices, they lose money when prices drop. Jim Corridor is an airline industry analyst with S&P Capital IQ.
Southwest has been doing worse than some of its peers of late. Up until 2008, 2009, they had the best hedging program in the industry. Right now, that's reversed itself a little bit.
But some say we shouldn't read too much into a single quarter.
The objective is not to hit the lottery on a quarter-by-quarter basis.
That's airline industry consultant Robert W. Mann.
It's very easy to look like you're a savant one quarter and then look like you're a dolt the next. That's really what we're seeing here with Southwest.
He says Southwest's fuel hedges have already recovered in this current quarter. Among major carriers, only one airline does not buy fuel hedges, U.S. Airways. That approach paid off for them last quarter. When oil prices fell, U.S. Air made money. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
And now, let's do the numbers. A seesaw day of trading left stocks a little bit higher and a little bit lower. The Dow Industrials inched up 37 points today. That's a third of 1% to 11,541. But the Nasdaq shaved off 5 points, nearly a quarter percent, finished at 2598. The S&P 500 tacked on 5 points, just shy of a half percent, closed at 1215. Investors were again following the bouncing ball on Europe's debt negotiations throughout the day, but near the close, they finally got some reassuring news. The leaders of Germany and France issued a statement pledging to have a bailout plan ready by next Wednesday, and that uplift some of the clouds over financial shares. Stock in J.P. Morgan Chase rang up 2.75%. Citigroup and Wells Fargo each advanced more than 2% today. Bank of America added 1% to the stock ledger. Video conferencing venture called Polycom was one of the biggest drags on the Nasdaq. The company reported quarterly profits well below expectations. Stock plunged more than 25% today. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department reports on regional and state unemployment rates for September. At the White House, President Obama signs the Korea, Panama, and Colombia free trade agreements. And she spawned a new hairstyle with Princess Leia. Actress and writer Carrie Fisher turns 55. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. One of the early observations about the Occupy Wall Street protests was that while they were against a whole bunch of things, they weren't necessarily for anything. It's still a little bit amorphous, but there is starting to be a push for something called a Robin Hood tax, a 1% tax on financial transactions and currency trades. It's not a new idea. It's about 40 years old, comes in and out of style with some regularity, and you might have heard of it as the Tobin tax, named for the Nobel Prize-winning economist who thought it up. Earlier this year, in fact, 1,000 economists signed a letter saying it would help fix our financial problems, and European officials have proposed it over in the European Union. But how might a Robin Hood tax work, beyond the whole take from the rich thing? Our New York bureau chief Heidi Moore has the story.
How do we end this deficit?
End the war! Tax the rich!
It's been 3 years since the bailouts. Banks are doing okay. So a lot of taxpayers are asking, where's our share?
There are people who are frustrated with Wall Street and therefore the markets and are looking for a way to ask those sectors of the economy to contribute more.
That's Clinton Stretch, a tax policy expert at Deloitte. The hot idea to even the score this year has been what's called the Robin Hood tax. It tends to come up whenever social justice and capitalism clash. The Occupy Wall Street protesters are being urged to demand a 1% tax on all financial transactions, from selling stocks to buying currencies. Matt Slaughter, a dean of Dartmouth Tuck School of Business, told me that the tax
sounds intuitive and maybe sounds just in some sense, but boy, like with a lot of things in public finance, the devil's in the details.
Slaughter says a 1% tax would deeply dent bank profits. Europe is proposing just a tenth of 1% on all stock and bond sales, and less for other transactions. Analysts say just that could raise up to 50 billion euros a year, or half the profit of Europe's 90 biggest banks. Banks will likely pass the costs on to consumers, but you would also pay the tax directly anytime you buy or sell a stock. And Stretch says the tax would affect our 401ks if fund managers hold off on trades to avoid the fees.
It's not clear to me that you really want to give your mutual fund manager an incentive to not do the very best thing for your account the moment that they perceive it's a good thing to do.
The Robin Hood tax has its own website as well as a Facebook page and a Twitter account. But despite its populist appeal, few economists think it will happen in the U.S. anytime soon. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
We often use Wall Street as a stand-in for the entire financial system, a giant machine that people just don't understand. But what if we think about it as a place where people work, where sometimes they succeed, sometimes they don't, just like the rest of us? That's how J.C. Shandor thought about Wall Street while he was making his latest movie, Margin Call, that opens tomorrow. J.C., welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
So I want to go straight, as they say, to the tape on this first question. It's Kevin Spacey, who plays a higher-up in this fictional firm, which is, you know, loosely based on Lehman Brothers, we should say, talking to his boss, the head of the firm, Jeremy Irons. Let's hit that tape.
The real question is, who are we selling this to?
Same people we've been selling it to for the last 2 years, and whoever else will buy it.
But, John, if you do this, you will kill the market for years. It's over. And you're selling something that you know has no value.
We are selling to willing buyers at the current fair market price so that we may survive.
So, first of all, is there anybody better at pure evil than Jeremy Irons? Right? But also, was that necessarily evil? I mean, put yourself in 2008, and yes, they did a lot of bad things, but these guys thought their backs were up against the wall, and they were doing, as you have Jeremy Irons saying, what they thought they had to do to survive.
You know, to give away a little bit of the movie, Spacey's character is the one that starts to take on what we as the audience feel is a conscience. And he's there sort of trying to pump the brakes. The really interesting thing about this scene, the scene that you just played, is that the character that you actually think is sort of the quote unquote more evil character is actually right. We as a shareholder in that company would expect Jeremy Irons' character to do exactly what he just said there. Now, the sort of frustrating slash interesting slash sort of fascinating thing about the film that we laid out here is that there actually is no pure evil. Each character is simply trying to act on the information that they have before them.
Is it easy now, or are they the go-to villains now, Wall Street guys?
You know, I think yes, to a certain extent. We are using them as a punching bag in this situation. And my feeling was there is always going to be a whole lot of bad things going on in the margins of the banking industry, just like there are in most industries. This film is not about those individuals. This film was about people kind of in the center of this system, right in the heart, that actually were not breaking any laws and weren't breaking any regulations. But ethically, I think when watching this film, certainly a good portion of the population would think that there is, you know, some significant ethical sort of violations going on. The system is there because we allow it to be there as citizens. And the exciting thing about what's going on and people out in the streets right now is that at least people are starting to speak out.
And as long as we're talking about Occupy Wall Street, which is what you were referring to right there, you can't buy this kind of timing to release a film about this stuff.
No, as I said, 3 years ago, I sat down to write a script, and you know, you don't sort of have the kind of absolute collapse that we had. And my gut said, you know, we weren't going to be quote unquote out of this mess by the time a movie comes out. But the fact that people feel compelled to protest against this system, to put a film, you know, into that environment so that hopefully to a very small extent, you're getting to have your film join the dialogue.
Yeah, that dialogue seems to me is getting a tad crowded. I mean, we had Too Big to Fail. There's Wall Street Part Two, whatever the subtitle was. I mean, there's no shortage of films out there trying to make sense of all this stuff.
Yeah, and I think Wall Street 2, you know, I think it suffered to a certain extent from the size of its budget, almost the opposite that we did with this film. You know, it was a $80 million movie or something, and this film, it was a $3 million film. And so we were never trying to, you know, make a film that would wrap up some entire movement or some entire situation that was going on in the world. We set out to essentially make a small film that looked at what at one point was the heart or the beginning of this issue and of this problem, and, you know, and look at the characters in the middle of that.
The film is called Margin Call by J.C. Shandor. He's the writer and director. J.C., thanks a lot.
Thank you.
One easy way to get a handle on the economic zeitgeist is to just plop yourself down in front of the television. A couple of years ago, every pitch man on the tube seemed to be selling stuff using an economic twist. And then the economy started to improve a bit, advertisers backed off. But now, as consumer sentiment sags and stocks do too, Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports downturn advertising is creeping back into our commercial breaks.
West Coast burger chain Carl's Jr. is known for its tongue-in-cheek ads. Its new commercials, featuring images of Wall Street signs and gold bars, are no exception.
Unlike the debt crisis, your appetite is something we can fix.
The ad suggests two bacon cheeseburgers for $5 will do the trick. The ad aired last month in most markets west of the Mississippi. Brad Haley is chief marketing officer of Carl's Jr.'s parent company, CKE Restaurants. He says this is the first time the company has referenced the economy so directly.
It's just the reality of day-to-day life for our customers and really for the general public.
And other advertisers are catching on. Tim Calkins teaches marketing at Northwestern's Kellogg School of Management.
Making sure advertising resonates is so important. And if your consumers are struggling economically, then the message has to change to address that.
For instance, Xerox ads tout its services for businesses struggling to streamline costs. Ameriprise Financial commercials reference bailouts. And the casual dining chain Chili's is running an ad that starts off with a common experience these days.
So I'm interviewing lots of candidates for this position. Why should I choose you?
But sometimes what people experience during the day is not what they want to hear about when they're trying to unwind at night. Calkins says that makes downturn-themed advertising tricky, especially in the next couple of months.
It is particularly challenging in the holidays because in the holiday time, people really don't want to be reminded of the dismal economy.
Calkins says that puts advertisers in a tough spot. Most of the larger ones take months to plan and produce an ad campaign. That means they run the risk of locking into a campaign that could be out of touch. Syracuse University pop culture professor Robert Thompson says some of the most nimble current events advertising comes not from nationwide chains, but in low-budget, often local commercials.
I think advertising's biggest signal to me that we've been in some economic trouble is the quantity of cash for gold advertisements I see.
Turn your gold into cash fast.
Don't mail in your gold to a stranger.
Get the most cash for your diamond, gold, and silver jewelry.
That nimble, low-budget model is turning up in bigger advertising campaigns, too. Remember those Carl's Jr. commercials for the bacon cheeseburger? Marketing chief Brad Haley says the chain didn't film anything new, but relied on stock footage of Wall Street and gold bars. He says the company produces about a third of its ads that way.
That can be turned around quickly, so it reflects exactly what people are thinking and talking about.
Sure, it's current, but Robert Thompson of Syracuse University says the ad worked mostly because it was irreverent.
That Carl's Jr. Wall Street ad was almost getting to the point where we're now parodying the idea of using the economic collapse to sell products.
And Thompson says, expect to see more ads of this kind if the economy continues to struggle. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, which is either the beginning of the end of Occupy Wall Street or its rise to a place in the cultural firmament, MTV is said to be auditioning Occupy protesters for roles in an upcoming season of its reality series, Real World. Both Entertainment Weekly and the blog Talking Points Memo spotted a Craigslist ad seeking likely candidates for the show. We called the casting company and MTV. They would neither confirm nor deny. They said only they are always looking for passionate people. And that's it. That's all we've got. It's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the markets closed mixed. The Dow nudged up 37 points, about a third of 1%. The NASDAQ down 5 points, a quarter percent. The S&P 500 took those 5 points, added them, not quite a half percent there. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Nancy Fragale, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, Lisa Tucker, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time back on The Big Show, we've got riots in Athens, protests on Wall Street, and a post-Gaddafi Libya. Sounds like the weekly wrap to me. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI?
I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.